You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 5th of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Chloe Potter, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, we're going to be pirouetting around some sparklingly different corners of the ballet scene. LA Dance Project's urgent pit stop at Sadler's Wells and the Royal Ballet's production of Don Quixote.
We'll also have jazz journalist Mike Flynn in the studio to take us on a tour of autumn's festival scene. He'll be introducing the scene's hot new band, Snarky Puppy, but will also be taking us back to the 1960s.
And we'll also be joined by novelist and New York Times contributor Tom Rackman to Art Talk. We find out if an attempt to marry new and old in London's Hyde Park makes for a successful new gallery, and ask when attacks on artists' work becomes art itself.
We'll also have our regular weekend look ahead and a special focus on what's on in Vienna. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Studio One at Midori House. Now, I promise we're going to have plenty of high culture for you on today's show. But Gillian, I know you're positively bursting to get stuck into a bit of Downton Abbey chat.
Well, in a cultural institution that it's become. I was really looking forward to get stuck into it on Sunday night when the new season premiered. Mm-hmm. The Sunday night before that. But I have to say, I was so disappointed that.
And you've been an avid fan up to this point.
I have been. Yeah, I've been watching them all and luxuriating in all the costumes and the characters and the denouements. But I just found they've become a brand. Like, pandering, I think, to international audiences, which they have to, and how you propel a series and keep enduring it when you never knew it was going to be so successful. You know, falling into plot themes.
You know, I wish this about so many box office, successful award-winning series. Homeland, I felt similarly about.
Yeah.
I wish they'd just leave it. That perfection of the first series, just end it there.
And you
let us all want more.
You want to be left wanting more. Mm. I think so. So there we go. So I think my Downton days have been numbered.
Okay. Oh, wow. Really? No more watching? Because it is essentially a soap opera. It's got that addictive quality, hasn't it?
Yeah. And the best series, you know, they can run. And there's that wonderful looking forward to an anticipation. Mm. And Julian Fellowes is absolutely brilliant. And I think he has done extraordinarily well.
Yes.
And not to say there aren't some amazing, amazing acting in the new series. But I just think having killed off some of the best characters because, you know, they wanted their careers to go different directions, a lot was lost.
Oh, such a shame. You're disappointed. I wonder if it's shared. you're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
And we begin today's show with dance from the premiere of a classical reinterpretation to new contemporary interpretations. This week has been an interesting one here in London. Cuban ballet idol Carlos Acosta unveiled his new and much anticipated production of Don Quixote at Covent Garden. And Benjamin Millepied, aka Mr. Natalie Portman, brought his LA Dance Project to the Sadler's Wells.
Well, here to join us to have a good old natter about this new generation of celebrity dancers and choreographers, and to ponder whether their new productions fulfilled expectations. We're delighted to welcome back to Monocle dance lover and writer for the Daily Telegraph, Louise Levine. Thanks for joining us, Louise.
Hello.
So first, let's start with Don Quixote. It's a challenging choice, isn't it? It's a surprising choice for them to take on. It's not got the best reputation.
They have a historic relationship with this ballet, and it isn't a happy relationship. The every time they try to buy in a version, they can't do it. They can't do the Spanish-Russian accent that it needs. And it's always a disappointment. They did it in 93. They did it in 2003 with a Nureyev production, which works all over the world. And they couldn't hack it with that. And now Acosta has had a go. And he's been dancing it his whole life. Mm. He was practically weaned on this ballet, both in Cuba. And he's danced it in St. Petersburg, in Paris. And he, of all people, should have been able to pull it off. And I'm afraid I was disappointed again.
So this was a season opener for the Royal Ballet and huge pressure on Acosta as a dancer suddenly to be in this more choreographer dancer role. Why do you think he chose this ballet?
Well, as I say, it's part of his makeup, and he probably thought that he, of all people, could bring it off. But it's a combination of things. The production itself is not entirely successful. The sets move around too much. Things have been cut, things have been added, which don't work as well as productions we in London know well. You know, the Russians come here with Don Q quite regularly. We had one in the spring, and we know better, and he knows better.
But didn't you find the exuberance? There's something Acosta brings. You're not used to smiling on a stage in the ballet. And I thought his charisma and his passion with his partner and then especially by the end, the crescendo in the third act, like I felt quite emotional with his performance.
He partnered absolutely beautifully. That was the best thing about it. But he's 40 years old now, and the whole point about the character, it's a tiny character in the Cervantes novel, who is the local barber, and he wants to marry the innkeeper's daughter, and the innkeeper has other ideas. And it's quite a small episode, but it's very sweetly done in the ballet scenario. But the point about the ballet and its lifeblood is the virtuosity of Basil. He has to be just burning testosterone, and it is a mixture of really hot bravura dancing and elegance, and that's not really coming through. I mean, he's a delight, and it's, as you say, tender, but that fire isn't there.
Louise, tell us a little bit about Acosta's background and his pedigree and what he brings to this production that's different.
Well, as I say, he brings a real Spanish accent. The Cubans were taught ballet by the Russians under license, as it were, and he evolved from being a naughty boy on the streets, the youngest of 13 children, I think it is, to going to ballet lessons instead. And you know, when you're built the right way, and you've got the physique and the looks and the as I say, fire, you know, you will succeed in Cuba. You know, Cuba has a great ballet tradition. And he was brilliant. He went to Houston, he came to London, and he's been all over the world. And he's put on his own shows, which have been a great success. But that doesn't necessarily prepare you for the groundwork involved in putting on a three-act ballet to which the company you are working with, you know, they're just not used to this ballet, and they've never done it convincingly for me. Now, you see, Gillian, you haven't seen it before.
And so, no, exactly. So, but you know, thanks to you, I was spending hours and hours at night, which I would recommend all listeners to go back and find the 1959 versions, the 1961 versions, the Paris versions, the Moscow versions, because it's extraordinary, especially to take that virtuoso sort of third act performance of the male lead and the female lead that technically must be so difficult. I mean, 32 pirouettes. I don't even know the technical language.
I mean,
so I was my breath was taken away. But when I went back to see other performances, but that was, I think, to me, the intrigue, just to see different interpretations, different technical expertise, different productions doing it. And I have to say, there are a lot of ballets which are wonderful for the prima ballerinas and men spin them around and hold them. This is a great role for a male dancer.
Oh, it is. I mean, he's the pulse of the ballet, the man at the heart of the ballet. And the great hope for this production is that other casts and more practice, because it was an under-rehearsed performance, as you will have noticed, I'm sure.
I've never before seen two people fall on stage in a classical ballet.
No, it's not. It doesn't happen very often, you know.
It's a huge weight on Acosta's shoulders, isn't it? Directing, choreographing, dancing.
And it hasn't been, on the whole, very well reviewed. I mean, and goodness knows there's the goodwill, because you know he's a darling, and he's a tremendously successful and passionate and interesting artist, and everyone wants him to succeed and wants it to be good. But you know, three stars in some quarters, you know, in old money, that's 2 stars. You know, they've been very
I have to say, on opening night though, the Royal Opera House looked exquisite. They set dressed it with red carnations and fans, and it has to be one of the most beautiful opera houses in the world.
It is, and it was very lovely. The second act of the ballet, which is where the Don gets hit on the head by a windmill and falls over and fantasizes about this beautiful visionary female he's in love with, is usually what they call a ballet blanc, and it's always very, very pale pastels, and the Queen of the Dryads comes out and you have the shimmering court of ballet. Well, they've recast this in a much, much more psychedelic manner with these giant gerberas, I think they are, those
and
big,
sunset,
big purple
flaming
daisies.
Sunset.
Yeah, and there were purple daisies all over the house, these great lollipops of flowers, and quite a lot of the audience in black tie, which is lovely. I'm a big fan of black tie.
So am I.
You know?
Yes.
Once upon
especially
a time,
for the ballet.
You know, the Paris Opera Ballet, opera and ballet used to have a special night. One performance of every ballet and every opera was black tie and long skirt. Same price. But if you wanted to do that, you could do that.
That was great.
Such a magical experience.
I really think they should do it because, God, people love dressing up.
Heaven.
Indeed, you could have cheaper nights where people dress up.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because it's not about money. It's not about class. It's about having a special time. And as you say, in a house so pretty... Mm. What an occasion.
It was.
It taps into the inner child, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. It shouldn't just be galas, you know, it should be for everybody.
Yeah. And do you think the approach that Carlos Acostas is taking is going to bring in a new generation of audience? You know, there's a smattering of the street dance heritage he has in his choreography in this production. Do you think that's what's needed to get a new generation of people in to watch ballet?
I think that is consistently a red herring as far as classical ballet is concerned. I think people of a certain age, young people, get taken to the ballet when they're little, so the seed is sown. But generally speaking, people in their 20s have other things to spend their money on, and bellyaching about the fact that they're not necessarily always at the theatre or the ballet or the opera is just silly, because they will go. You know, they don't buy stair lifts either. You know,
but that's
these
what it's amazing
happen.
Though, that the Royal Opera House is doing big screen performances. They're doing live broadcasts all around the world on big screens so that it won't just be the elite in Covent Garden that can see it. In London and in other cities, they're doing these incredible big screen
and also
relays.
In cinemas, and it's really, really high quality as well. I've been to some myself, you know, nice high definition and, you know, and directed by people who know. Because it's very hard, you know, to know where to look. The pan and scan quality can be very frustrating if you normally look at this point on the stage and they've chosen to focus on something else. But it's done very, very intelligently, and it's, you know, it's affordable and it's near you. I mean, I think that's absolutely tremendous. I mean, the Mariinsky and the Bolshoi do the same, as you know, and the Met also. And it opens up art to a much bigger international audience, which is so important because it can get very parochial.
Absolutely.
That screening from the Royal Opera House, in case you want to see it, is on Wednesday the 16th of October at 7:15. And as Gillian was saying, it's an unprecedented broadcast across the world. So lots of opportunity to see it if you wish. We wanted to talk to you about a very different production, LA Dance Project, over at Sadler's Wells. And that, at its helm, there's another sort of celebrity dancer and choreographer, Benjamin Millepied, Mr. Natalie Portman, as Gillian said. Tell us your thoughts on that. Very different to what's going on at the Royal Opera House.
Sure. I mean, it's a small company, only founded last year. And you wouldn't normally expect a 7-man company to get a run at Sadler's Wells or sell as well as it seems to have done. I mean, it wasn't a full house, but, you know, 7-man British dance companies don't get that kind of profile. And he is, of course, why they have it. Next year, he takes up the reins at the Paris Opera Ballet, which was a huge surprise. A huge surprise. I mean, there were an awful lot of men in pole position for that job who had, you know, lived the CV for that job, who must have been very surprised indeed that someone with no tradition of actually running a ballet company. It's 150 dancers in Paris, you know, let alone
and one of the Byzantines, the oldest and the biggest.
Yeah, the Byzantine structure of the organization itself. It's that is a very tall order, and there are clearly ambulance chasers kind of accelerating into position behind that decision to see, well, how can it possibly go right? But, you know, the celebrity will carry you a long way.
Yes.
And he is a talented choreographer.
But he is passionate about dance. Yeah, and this absolutely. LA project really shows that he felt, especially in LA, when he moved to LA, he didn't feel that dance was well served in LA. And, you know, funding is non-existent in a way unless you go the philanthropic route. And so he has pulled together, and with his sort of entrepreneurial acumen, he's pulled together finance to help nurture new choreography, and that in itself is I think a great sort of starting point for someone
using
who really
his celebrity
wants to do.
For yeah, something yeah, yeah. good.
That said, it was quite a dry evening, wasn't it? Yes, I mean it was not that the individual pieces were not of themselves of interest, but as a program, it was very earnest and low key.
I think we have a little clip of music that we want to play in, just to start us off for a little bit of conversation talking point. Here it is.
Blood never fails with me. Yet never fails with me. Yet Jesus' blood never fails with me. Yet this one thing I know, for he loves me so.
The music that accompanied the final piece that the LA Dance Project performed. I think it's an apt time to mention a quote from Millepied, which is, ballet doesn't have to be pleasing, it doesn't have to be romantic.
Of course not. No, nobody ever said it did, but a triple bill should have a little light and shade. But that, I mean, that's nothing to do with that music. That music is a great divider. You know, people either find it utterly transcendent or they want to slit their wrists.
I think it's transcendent for the first 5 minutes, but when it goes on for how many? 20 minutes?
Oh, very easily.
I was on the slitting of the wrist side of the audience.
It was an extraordinary piece of music. As you know, it was made by Gavin Bryars, heard a tramp singing this snatch of him, recorded him, and never found him again, and then worked a kind of plangent chords around this continuous loop, which, you know, could still be going on for, like, it goes on for days. But people love it very, very much, and Forsyth did, and Forsyth found it incredibly moving when he was writing this piece, which was all about the death of his wife. And it's a fabulous piece of choreography. I'd kind of like to take another piece of music on my headphones while watching it, I have to say. And I thought the dancers coped with it brilliantly. My favourite piece of the evening was the piece by the young choreographer Justin Peck, which was Murder Ballads, which I thought was tremendous. I mean, he has got.
I mean, that really
gifts.
Drew you
yeah.
In terms
he's
of
got
quite
real
hypnotic
gifts.
In the
yeah,
in,
and
in
also
the
his use of the space, his use of the dancers, the way he can, you know, use an ensemble and then have them peel away and leave a solo. Mm. That sounds so easy, but you know, any director, any novelist will tell you, get that many people in a space and getting them down to a pair or back up to a full complement is really, really talented. And he did it with such
fluidity,
interest. And it was, you know, there were no cliches and it was consistently interesting. I was really encouraged by that. I thought it was great. And the company is now going to be under kind of overall control of Millepied, sort of vaguely from Paris, but it's going to continue without him, as I understand.
Ah, I have to say, I found the evening quite an intimate experience. There's no obvious narrative necessarily, or you don't feel there is, and you feel it's quite a private experience when you're watching it, and then you talk about it afterwards and you realise everyone, it's touched the same things in everyone. There was lots about relationships, about longing, about rejection, about community, love.
Funnily enough, I thought Millepied's piece was the weakest of the three. I thought it went on too long. I thought it was self-indulgent. It could have stopped or started at any point. And the structure was lost on me, at least, on the first viewing. I mean, maybe one would grow into it. But happily, he's got a really mixed bag of dancers, different shapes, sizes, levels of experience. I thought Charlie Hodges, the smaller bald man, was tremendous. I mean, a real personality, a real presence on stage in all three pieces.
Well,
it was terrific.
Yes, all eyes will be on Millepied's as he moves to Paris to become director of dance there. Thank you so much, Louise Levine, for joining us. That was a lovely pirouette around the world.
We look forward to our next one.
Thank you.
Each Sunday on Monocle 24, we like to take stock. The wonder of history for the journalist is you can delve into this immense booty of information.
I don't even know what to think about that.
Take the global pulse. I was at a Bunga Bunga party the other day.
And?
I wasn't at all. I just wanted to start a show like that. We're 187 shows down. How's your week been?
I'm feeling 187, actually.
And occasionally take things down a notch, too.
I had a pair of plum suede loafers with gold snaffles. And a guy stopped his car and leant out of the window and said it was people like me who were bringing this country to its knees.
To end the week with the best chat.
We know that he had them and we know that he'd used them before.
Because we still had the receipts.
Well, there's that.
Some great music.
Do you know, I never thought that I might need to have a question about death metal, but I'm warming up.
And some good fun to set up Sunday and warm the week ahead. The Monocle Weekly. Your week starts here.
You're listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Chloe Potter.
Let's spin the globe now to look at cultural highlights from around the world. Here's Monocle's Toronto Bureau Chief Nelly Gotcheva with her picks of interesting and intriguing happenings this weekend.
If in London this weekend, stop by the Marlborough Contemporary near Piccadilly Circus to check out the solo exhibition of Cuban artist Diango Hernandez. This is Hernandez's first solo exhibition in the United Kingdom, where he explores his home country through the personal lens of his memories. The exhibition is on until the 26th of October. Our second offering from London this weekend is Leonardo Julian's Sacred Space exhibition at the Beers Lambert Gallery. Running until the 9th of November, the show explores the relation between the cult and the technology in a series of Hindu and Buddhist mandalas. In Sydney, award-winning photographer Simon Harrison expresses his love for football in his latest solo exhibition entitled The Beautiful Game. Housed in the Black Eye Gallery, the images portraying players and audience provide a rare glimpse into past games and into the football stadium. The Beautiful Game is on until the 27th of October. Opening earlier this week in Vancouver is Capture Photo Fest. This is the city's first annual photography festival dedicated to celebrating local and international photography. The festival runs for 6 weeks until the 15th of November and will feature 50 special exhibitions across the city. The festival runs for 6 weeks until the 15th of November and will feature 50 special exhibitions. For the full listing of events, go to capturephotofest.com. This weekend we'll be listening to the techno sounds of Swedish-born and Berlin-based musician The Field, also known as Axel Willner. His new album, Cupid's Head, is out now. And now let's hear him with Cupid's Head. For Monocle, in Toronto, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
That was Cupid's Head by The Field, ending that report there by Nelly Gotcheva.
It's time now for our weekly music review, and today we are all about jazz. And joining us in our jazz talk is award-winning music journalist and bass guitarist Mike Flynn from Jazzwise magazine.
Hello.
Mike, thanks so much for joining us again. Autumn, it seems, is a busy time of year for you, the season for jazz festivals.
I know. I mean, personally, we have the, speaking about London, we have London Jazz Festival coming up. We'll talk about that in a bit. And it seems everybody seems to wait till the autumn before they decide to go on tour. So basically, we are inundated with musicians spreading out around Europe, around America, getting out on tour. And
but what is the appetite like for jazz? I mean, is it sort of, you know, golden oldies? Is there a new generation that are really kind of growing?
Is. There is a new generation coming through. I mean, I think the old way of doing jazz, shall we say, is still extremely popular. And, you know, it's I think it's considered a thing among musicians to actually learn the tradition. Mm. You know, you need to go back to your roots. It's almost like an abstract painter learning to draw before they go kind of freak out, you know. And so I think it's the same with that. And I think there's, you know, I mean, actually later on, we're hopefully going to hear a track by Wayne Shorter, which is going to be, a classic jazz track. And actually, when you go back to those kind of classic things, it's incredibly rewarding. And so I think there's still part of the art form that needs to be cherished. And that's that part of it. But obviously, we also hear from another band called Snarky Puppy, who are all about the new generation of fans, not really because they're the iPod generation. They've grown up with a shuffle function rather than a record player. Mm. And even though vinyl is coming back in a big way, I think the eclectic tastes of contemporary audiences are actually starting to influence bands because they're now not worried about, hey, can we have a jazzy bit and a rocky bit? You know, the whole thing can coexist. But that also goes into dance music and soul and other things as well. So
Mike, you wanted to start by talking about a festival that's happening in Finland.
Indeed.
And one of the bands that's going to be featured there.
Absolutely. There's a whole range of jazz festivals happening throughout Europe. You've got Frankfurt Jazz Festival, Berlin Jazz Festival, the Vilnius Jazz Festival in Lithuania. But the Finland Tampere Jazz Happening is a wonderful, very compact festival. You can get around it very easily. Has a fantastic array of international talent there. You must catch Edmar Castaneda, this amazing harpist, if you get to see him. He's from Colombia. But the track we're going to hear is a track by a guy called Manu Kache. He's an incredible drummer who worked with Peter Gabriel and Joni Mitchell. But he's actually now on ECM, the very prestigious German jazz label, and has a beautiful album just under his own name. And the track we're going to hear is called Running After Years and features the trumpeter Niels-Petter Molvær.
Let's have a listen. Mike, that was Running After Years by Manu Kache, who are going to be at this Finnish festival that you were telling us about. It's really immersive, that.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously ECM, they're very much known for their production style, which is all about beautiful sound quality, highly atmospheric. And it's very much European sort of jazz. And it's funny, actually, because a lot of American jazz musicians are now recording for that label. Guys like Chris Potter and Tim Byrne, who were very kind of hot names on the New York scene. And but they kind of come over there and they're actually exploring a slightly different sensibility. And so but Manu Kache, using Niels-Petter Molvær there and a couple of other Norwegian musicians, you know, creates this beautiful mix of melody, atmosphere, there's an improvisation, you know, but it's a different take on jazz.
And wonderful performances, and you listen to the music, and great musicians. And I'm wondering at festivals like this if there's much cross-pollination between musicians. Do they find some musicians just mix and start to play with each other? And
it does happen. I mean, you know, the next festival I wanted to highlight, also happening in October, is the Cork Jazz Festival. And they have a very eclectic bill where they've got got, you know, kind of Billy Cobham, this great drummer from, you know, he's still great, but he played with Miles Davis back in the day and is a great name in his own right. But he's on a double bill with Portico Quartet, who are this London-based band who were nominated for the Mercury Prize. They've since moved from being quite jazzy, more into electronica. So that's very eclectic. And then the another double bill that's happening, which links our next track, is actually between the Mingus Big Band, who, of course, keep the legacy of Mingus, the Charles Mingus Big Band, the great bass player. They keep his legacy alive, but also another bass player called Michael League, who leads Snarky Puppy, who are this band who have been going for 10 years. They've only just really, in the last year and a half, started to break into Europe and the UK. And they are so eclectic. I mean, they mix all styles, but the thing they're doing is they're finding a young audience. And they're finding it, they're mainly instrumental. The track we're going to hear features Layla Hathaway, but actually, they've done a lot of this without vocals, which is interesting.
Mike, I have to... Do you know the origins of their name? They're a Brooklyn band, aren't they?
Indeed. It's one of these things with band names. You know, I play bass, I play in bands, and we always think of names. And it's like, you know, you think of the name Radiohead. If you put that in isolation, it sounds kind of silly. But over time, it loses its silliness and just becomes a name.
Becomes a name. Snarky Puppy.
Well, at least you remember
the
this
result.
Band.
Yeah, very memorable, as you say. Good for the iPod generation. Let's have a listen. This is Something. So that's Something featuring Layla Hathaway by Snarky Puppy. Had us all bopping along in the studio, all of us.
Swaying.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very accessible, isn't it?
Indeed, indeed. And they're actually playing a big gig in London on the 17th of November. And, you know, I think the point I think about some of these international jazz festivals is that actually, no matter where you go, you're going to actually get an incredibly, a huge cross-section of international music. And, sometimes with a little bit of repetition, actually. You know, so Marcus Miller, who's playing at London Jazz Festival, has been out at other jazz festivals this year. But actually, sort of, you know, the London Jazz Festival, again, it kind of goes a bit deeper into the kind of club level. There's education things. There's so much going on. It's a little bit mind-blowing, to be honest. But, I guess we should highlight a few people there. One being Wayne Shorter, the very iconic saxophonist who, you know, obviously worked with Miles Davis, as everybody does. But he has had his own kind of very sort of iconic solo career. He's just turned 80. And I mean, you know, everyone makes a big deal out of the Rolling Stones turning 70. But actually, this guy is still playing at a phenomenally high level, but also writing music for symphony orchestras, and he's actually appearing with the BBC Concert Orchestra.
It's an industry, an area of the music industry that's certainly not ageist, is it? It's all about skill and experience. And
totally. And also that kind of experience then lends whatever someone like Wayne Shorter plays with so much more kind of weight and gravitas that, you know, a younger player with great technique just doesn't have, you know. I was sort of thinking about these guys, and, you know, Miles Davis and Wayne, they are like painters, you know. So they've all had their blue period, which is actually a period on Blue Note Records in the 1960s, which is just produced the most phenomenal back catalogue of music. And if you go back, I mean, the lineup on this track that we're going to hear features Wayne Shorter, Freddie Hubbard, Herbie Hancock, Ron Carter, and Elvin Jones. I mean, five of the absolute icons of each of their instruments. And, you know, and the track's called Speak No Evil, but it's actually from a whole series of albums that Wayne did about that time that, you know, he might be going completely experimental now, but if you delve back into his past, you're going to find some incredible music to listen to.
Let's have a listen.
So that's Speak No Evil from the album Speak No Evil by Wayne Shorter, Mike, your final track for today. Really evocative of a different era, as you'd expect.
Absolutely.
Filmic, 90s. It just brings it to life, doesn't it?
Totally. And I mean, the wonderful thing with these sessions from Blue Note, I mean, I'm not a huge expert on that era, so I'm not going to kind of say that anything too much. But basically, you know, these sessions were cut very quickly in the studio. The bands would be rehearsed and they'd go in, do a couple of takes. And, you know, and it all came out on mono vinyl, which, you know, if it just has a sort of immediacy. It's almost like the early Beatles records where no matter where you hear it, it just conjures that sound and that era so quickly and powerfully, you know.
I know everybody, all these musicians, should be doing it for the love, not the money. But I am wondering in today's world how viable it is to be a jazz musician. And do these musicians have to, you know, have different lives and day jobs to just sustain their passion of music and this kind of music?
They do indeed. And I think, you know, there's certainly an area where you can cross over and have a hit single or certainly a hit album. But, you know, a lot of jazz musicians day to day, that, you know, they're often in education or a lot of, you know, because I mean, especially in America, you know, jazz education is a huge business over there. There are literally thousands of courses and they're not cheap, believe me. And basically that you can learn. The problem is, of course, we have a surplus of fantastic musicians with a lack of gigs. So you have to go on tour and, a lot of the big bands. I mean, this is perhaps an upside of the thing, is the fact that people like Beyonce, say, or whatever, their band will be full of amazing musicians. They'll have a full brass section. They'll have a fantastic drummer, a bass player, who are all, you know, world-class players. And so I feel like, you know, jazz is actually having a subliminal effect on mainstream music in the live arena, because actually when you go and see a commercial band, you will actually be seeing a lot of jazz musicians on stage. Yeah. And I mean, I know a drummer who's been on tour with Robert Plant playing to 30,000 people a night. I know a brilliant pianist in London called Tom Corley, who actually plays with Peter Gabriel. And Peter Gabriel did an album recently called You Scratch My Back or something, which was all about kind of taking his classic songs and playing them in an acoustic way with an orchestra. And Tom actually, you know, he's a superb musician. Saw him the other day, and he's on tour playing the O2 and playing massive concerts with Peter Gabriel. So I think as a jazz, I think, you know, if you're in the arts today, you've got to be diverse. Mm-hmm. You've got to be versatile.
And
otherwise,
pollination is where the creative juices are going to flow.
Absolutely. And I think it's also about mixing it up a bit and maybe trying something new. And, you know, jazz is all about flexibility and improvising. And I think, you know, a lot of the great musicians are tapping into those other areas of music, and hopefully the audience are coming with them and they're not so bothered about the boundaries anymore between genres. You
Mike Flynn, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolute
on today's
pleasure.
Review. What a brilliant autumn you've got to look forward to.
Absolutely.
Time now to move to Vienna to hear what's coming up over there in the coming days. Our Vienna correspondent Alexei Korolov is here to guide us through the city's highlights, including a retrospective of Austrian artist Oskar Kosciuszko. Sorry about that. I will get that. And singer Cassandra Wilson's date at Vienna's largest jazz club.
Vienna is one of Europe's art capitals, that's for sure. And there's a lot happening on the city's arts calendar right now. But let us first look at design. Vienna Design Week 2013 is winding up this weekend. Its last 2 days feature shows and lectures, as well as a workshop on how design can help alleviate pain from arthritis. This year, festival headquarters is located in an old school building, which had been specially livened up for the occasion. So do hurry, you only have until Sunday, the 6th of October. Now to visual arts. Friday saw the opening of an exhibition celebrating the life and work of Austrian painter and writer Oskar Kokoschka at the Leopold Museum. Apart from Kokoschka's paintings and graphic designs, the show also features a selection of rare photographs from the life of a man who's considered to be one of the leading exponents of expressionism and modernism. Having just opened, Kokoschka, The Self in Focus, runs until the 27th of January next year. Now, let's linger in Kokoschka's time for the moment. An in-depth exhibition of Austrian art around the year 1900 is currently on display at Vienna's iconic Belvedere Museum. The most comprehensive show on the subject to date, Decadence, Aspects of Austrian Symbolism, tells the story of this curling, sensual, sexual art, and features works by the likes of Gustav Klimt, Egon Schiele, and Coleman Moser. Turn of the century Vienna was definitely a place to be, and those wishing to get a taste of it have until next Sunday, the 13th of October. And finally, on the music side, the US genre-defying singer Cassandra Wilson is joined by the jazz band Harriet Tubman, named after the famous abolitionist, for a special night at Vienna's largest jazz club, Porgy and Bess, on Friday, the 11th of October. Wilson combines genres as diverse as jazz, pop, and rap, and has won 2 Grammy Awards. All I want is a room somewhere far away. For Monaco in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev. With one enormous chair, oh, wouldn't that be lovely? Lots of chocolate for me to eat, lots of cold burning, lots of heat, warm face, warm hands, warm feet. Oh, wouldn't that be lovely?
Sounds of Cassandra Wilson ending that report there. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24, and we'll be back in just a moment with details of a brand new gallery that's just opened in London's Hyde Park. We'll be discussing its inaugural exhibition and finding out if the boldly designed space is a success.
The perfect way to start the day on the East Coast or in Latin America, your lunchtime catch-up in Europe, The Briefing is Monocle 24's fast-paced news and business show, bringing you up to speed with all the day's biggest stories.
It is absolutely vast. It's palatial in its proportions, this building, and it really reflects just how important the role of Mayor of Paris is.
Monocle's team of in-house experts bring you all the latest news on media and aviation, defence and technology, while an editor is on hand to run through the morning's front pages from Bogota to Boston.
You have all these people scrambling, you have all these investigators involved, and we still don't have a clear reason as to why these batteries did what they did.
My feeling is that politicians eat and try to enrich themselves and tax us.
That's The Briefing, every weekday at midday in London and 7 a.m. in New York, in association with BlackBerry.
Are you tired of overcooked and overrated culinary trends that never quite hit the spot? Fed up of being spoon-fed half-baked ideas on the next big thing? Then tune into The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Every week we introduce you to the world's top makers and shakers, cocktail creators and the best bread makers as we uncover gourmet street food, big-time baristas and wily wineries.
Once upon a time it was seen with disdain, but over the years that culture had gotten so popular it's iconic now.
If you're serving decent food in East London, I don't think you've got any problem getting custom in. And I worked in the West End for years, you know. I mean, it's not always packed in the West End, trust me.
This is the show that discovers how coffee can change a country and how chocolate can make us live longer, all in the search for exciting local food producers and the most original entrepreneurs.
That's The Menu, every Friday at 1900 hours London time.
Welcome back. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Gillian Tobias, and Chloe Potter. Time now to consider some art and some architecture.
Yes, the Serpentine's new gallery, The Sackler, has just opened its doors in London's Hyde Park. The exhibition space is an old gunpowder store dating from 1805, but the addition of a starkly white, tented cafe space by Iraqi-British architect Zaha Hadid, someone not known for her subtlety, has elicited mixed reactions. Meanwhile, the inaugural exhibition inside by young Argentinian artist Adrian Villarojas plays appropriately with themes of time and legacy.
Joining us in the studio to discuss all of this is Tom Rachman, author of the best-selling novel The Imperfectionist and contributor to The New York Times. Welcome.
Thank you.
I think we have a very interesting new addition to London that throws up so many interesting ideas about cities using buildings. And so I was quite pleased to take a little morning off yesterday and put it down to the Serpentine. I was wondering, you know, your first visit outside and in, what were your impressions? Outside first.
Yeah, outside first. I think that I was expecting something a little more, I have to say. I think that given the amount of attention that it got, I was expecting a creation that was a little more dramatic, a little more impressive. It was perfectly all right, but I think that if I had to compare it to something, it looks a little bit like a wedding tent. Call it sort of Smurf hats.
Yes, it's been compared, in fact, to a super yacht showroom. Which is harsh, isn't it?
Or a molar tooth.
It's in a stark contrast to the old building.
I think that's okay, though. Biggest disappointment is that Zaha Hadid is such an obvious person to commission, and so many of her buildings all look the same. Wouldn't it be amazing to get some new, different, lesser-named architect who could still play with modernity in the past? And I mean, I just did a film on Todd Saunders, the Norwegian architect who does incredibly contemporary architecture in nature. I think, and he's just one of, I think, so many interesting architects I think could have pondered that space and that assignment and created something unexpected.
I agree. And I think that it suffers a little bit, the new structure suffers a little bit by comparison to the annual temporary pavilions that are set up adjacent to the Sackler Gallery, the existing Sackler Gallery. Those are by invitation, I believe, and they change. They last for about half a year, and often they're absolutely glorious. They're wonderful additions and
playful.
They rarely match the structure, the original Sackler, the original Serpentine gallery structure. But I don't think that matters. Mm. Even this year, I believe it's a Japanese architect who has done quite a beautiful structure, which contains a cafe, and to me, it's
like white pickup sticks.
Exactly. Yeah. Well put. And it seems to me a much more elegant and inviting setting for a cafe than the Zaha Hadid tent.
Hadid has, in fact, in the past done her own
pavilion.
She did
the first one.
Yes,
the very first one.
And this cafe space is her first permanent building in Britain. It's been described as pouring milk, the fluidity, silk. For me, I was disappointed by the outside. I felt like it looked like it was squeezed into the space and its scale was wrong. Inside, I was much more pleasantly surprised. It's a really light space. It really responds to the natural environment of the park. But I felt like I'm not sure how timeless it's going to be. It felt very now, and perhaps that's because she's more used to temporary structures. Even the colour scheme, it felt like in a year it's going to seem quite dated.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck to see that the fabric over the top of it is already looking a little bit stained and dirty, which shocked me. But as to the inside of the cafe, I'm afraid that I can't really speak to that, because when I tried to enter, I was summarily expelled.
Oh.
not for the reasons that they recognized me, but simply because I walked in and I was looking, trying to get a glimpse of it all, and I was asked rather abruptly, you know, may I help you, with the meaning, may I not help you at all?
Well, we were there yesterday, and in sharp contrast, incredibly friendly in the cafe. So, but turning to the inside of the old building that's been reworked into a gallery space, and the exhibition, the inaugural exhibition in there, it's by a young Argentinian artist.
Site-specific work.
Yeah, very site-specific. And it's interesting to ask the question, is every exhibition in that space going to be site-specific?
I doubt that it will be. I think that probably they're looking to tie this particular exhibition to the opening of the gallery, to the idea of reinventing this space. And this particular exhibition, which is by Adrián Villar Rojas, Today We Reboot the Planet, is a wonderful one, I thought. I really enjoyed it. I don't know what you thought of it.
Adored it.
Really immersive. From the brick floor, which has been laid as part of the piece, which tinkles really pleasingly as you walk across it and really transports you and all the other people inside the gallery to a different place. It's got that amazing mix of futuristic and ancient.
Which is so thoughtful as well. You walk in and there's this massive, massive elephant made in very raw clay. And on his shoulders, he's holding like the structure of the building. It's like the weight of history, the weight of art, the way you can interpret in so many ways. And I think looking at that, the rawness, the cracks in the form, an elephant, that's what I quite like about an exhibition, where it's not trendy, but it does provoke you to contemplate it. And you can just stand there thinking and enjoying the shapes and the thoughts. I adore that elephant.
Yeah, the elephant is wonderful. I've heard the artist speaking about his intent for this exhibition. He's very much affected by the terrible damage that human beings have done to the environment. Mm-hmm. This is one of the themes that often comes up in his work. And it's also in part why he uses unfinished clay like that, because having left it only for a few weeks, it begins to decay, it begins to crack. Mm. And so the second part of this exhibition, after the glorious elephant, is a sort of cabinet of curios in the middle of the gallery with all different artifacts from the contemporary era, as if they had been found, let's say, after an apocalypse or after the terrible destruction by humanity of the world. And so you find all little artifacts and from our present day. And it's quite intriguing, and I think it will delight people to be able to go in and peek around that. And after that, then there's a third section, which is an even sharper contrast, just a naked chapel-like space, which I found to be absolutely beautiful. Mm. It's that the light comes really from stained glass windows that he's created at either side above the entrances, and again you have the lovely little clicks of the unfixed bricks that you mentioned. I loved that part particularly. Mm.
Yes. And all those curios you talked about, the strange juxtaposition of an iPod next to a potato that's sprouting, suggesting a different species, perhaps, who don't understand how those things were juxtaposed in the world. And it's a really interesting, it evokes that sense of going around a museum looking at Roman artifacts and not really understanding maybe how they were used and in what context. And the sort of the whole thing feeling like one big fossil, fossilized elephant and then a fossilized man lying there among all sorts of artifacts. It's just another species that died out once upon a time.
To me, the fascinating thing was just, I've always found the notion of archaeologists very kind of romantic, and their addiction to discovering and finding things. And it's finding out about a period in time and a history. All these pieces are witnesses to a past and a time. And it could be something very trivial and very mundane, which was part of the beauty of Pompeii, something frozen in time. So you saw the baby or the spoon or the food.
And you were in the moment.
And this kind of had that drama, but in a very, very small way. Mm. I thought it was wonderful.
We all clearly enjoyed it. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for talking about that one, because we want to get in a few minutes talking about another exhibition, very different, Art Under Attack over at the Tate Britain. It's an interesting topic for a gallery to tackle. You wouldn't necessarily expect it. Do you think it works?
I think it works tremendously well. I found it to be a fascinating exhibition and a rather brave one, too. Galleries are very understandably reluctant to publicize attacks on art. Mm. They're worried, obviously, about provoking more, about giving publicity to... Yeah, copycat attacks is always a terrible concern. And I think, though, that this quite bold exhibition, which traces attacks on art over the past 500 years within Britain or within British art, I think that it manages to convey the real meaning that can be contained in some of the attacks, which clearly isn't to legitimize them, but to try to understand them as a sort of spillover of an ongoing battle in societies for what to venerate, what it is that we consider beauty, what it is we ought to worship, and the ways in which there's a contest always going on. The exhibition begins 500 years ago with religious attacks on art, religious motivated, and then it moves on to political ones in the 18th century, 19th century, and early 20th century, and then to aesthetically motivated attacks. I found that it was, it's an interesting exhibit in that you're not, typically when you go to an exhibition, you go in expecting to find pieces of beauty, something that you'll never forget, that you'll adore and that will move you in that way. This one I found very, very stimulating. Not that it wasn't full of pieces that were gloriously beautiful necessarily, but there were in certain cases fragments of art that had been devastatingly attacked, and it was fascinating in what it said about the power of art.
And
not just in the figurative way that we always say art is powerful, but in the way that art and power do interact.
And that that question hanging there of when you celebrate something and when an attack adds layers, when an attack creates new art out of old art, and when it should be condemned.
Absolutely. I think it's a very tense subject, and particularly on the more recent attacks. There was an attack last year of Rothko mural at the Tate Modern, which is a sister gallery to Tate Britain. And there was, I'm sure, in the art world, a certain degree of nervousness about even approaching this, in the fear that you might somehow elevate these things by trying to find what they're about. But I think that this they managed to keep on the right side of it.
Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for on today's review. Thank you so much for joining us, Tom. Do tune in next weekend and have a wonderful weekend.